Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's cornhole season and the bags just keep flying. Your Minnesota Timberbeasts would love to see you in the crowd cheering on their crazy corn throwing capacity. The next big event is this weekend against the scourge of southern Wisconsin, the Beloit Bagpipers. And it's Cob Hat Night. That's right. The first 200 fans in attendance will be given corn cob hats. The hats are oversized replicas of a full ear of corn, emblazoned with the Timberbeasts logo right on the cob. The Timberbeasts are having another amazing year and would love to have you cheering for them in the front row. Come out and help your Timberbeasts get that corn airborne. What more could you want? Cob Hat Night this weekend and all the air mailing you can stand against our Southern Wisconsin competition, the Beloit Bagpipers. Join the Timberbeasts this weekend and howl your support for the home team. Pro League Cornhole Fever. Catch it.
From the glow of St. Paul's number one, welcome to another edition of Cabin Country. Give us the time and we'll take you out of the traffic and away from the levee. Let's find the place where the loons call out among the moonlit waves, where the wind sighs among the Norway pines. Pull up a dock chair, have a sip of your coffee, and get a line in the water. This is Cabin Country. Now here's Bjorn Lloydsted, and I'm Fudd Klugman with another woodland escape.
Well, hey, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Cabin Country, and we are glad to have you join us again tonight, and we are honored tonight with someone as a guest, kind enough to join us. I like to refer to as sort of a Cabin Country Renaissance man, Captain Dave Stricker. You've heard him mentioned many times on the podcast. He is, among other things, a licensed Great Lakes captain. He can take you out on the big water for the right price. Just kidding, of course. Spent a number of years building homes up in around the kind of the Duluth area, the Hermantown area. And on top of that, he's also a sitting board member on the aforementioned Minnesota Commercial Fishing Museum.
Yes.
Which we featured prominently in our episode, The Old Man and Gitche Gumee, which was...
That's right, with Helmer Ockvik.
Story of Helmer Ockvik.
Yeah, sure.
Cap'n, you were kind of the lead-in to that. How did that information come about that you were made aware of it and decided to pass that on to Cabin Country?
Well, I've always been intrigued by anything of kind of old North Shore-ish.
Right.
But also how folks really made their way, even before Highway 61 became a thing. I mean, when it was first dirt.
Right.
There's an author by the name of Marlon Breed, mm-hmm. and he decided to describe... He called it this old man who had gone out to save Carl, the younger fisherman.
He shouldn't have gone out.
I just was absolutely captured. One thing led to another, and the internet being as it is, I ended up stumbling on the North Shore Commercial Fishing Museum. They have some really captivating pictures. He was probably close to 90 when they took some of his photos. The recording that you guys featured was probably when he was maybe 80, do you think? Maybe
sounds about right, yeah. He was an older gentleman, that's for sure.
Yeah, that story was particularly compelling, especially since he ended up with an award which I don't know if you picked this up in the recording, but he didn't think much of the awards or letters that he received.
People went crazy for nothing.
You remember the take where he talked about how he just kept putting these letters he'd received in an old beer case.
Yeah, sure.
Didn't know what to do with them.
He didn't know what to do with them. Since they came from people he didn't really know, that was probably even of less value. So.
Right. Well, and I love the fact that he was saying he was opening these letters and there was money in them. You know, sometimes $1, sometimes $5, sometimes $2. Yeah. They were sending me money. Yeah. Yes, indeed, Helmer. You went out to try to save somebody's life in crazy weather. And I love that bit from the interviews where I think the host says, well, how far out were you, Helmer? I mean, how far did the lake take you? And he made it sound like somewhere between 25 and 50 miles out to shore, offshore. And then the current started bringing him back because his engines froze over and his hands and feet were darn near frozen. And
I tell you, there you go.
Yeah, that's a neat part of that story where he actually ended up dumping both motors into the lake because of the weight savings.
Yeah.
As a result of all the ice buildup. But what I thought was kind of funny is the Coast Guard finally tried to get his skiff. It roped his skiff, kind of lassoed it. And then as a result, ended up sinking it.
They tried to lasso the skiff, you see, to tow it. Lost it. I said, forget it.
Ended up sinking it. And do you recall the part where said, well, that was just a result of the lack of seamanship.
From the Coast Guard, of all people.
From the Coast Guard.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Outstanding.
Yeah, but another interesting part of when he kind of knew his life was coming to a close. He died of bone cancer at 90.
Okay.
And what was kind of interesting was he kind of took it, and this is what's so enduring about those families, not necessarily just the men, but those families, as you probably noticed when they talked to Christine in that recording.
Yeah.
Those folks were their tried and true grit, but I think even more compelling was this idea that they kind of took life as it came. They accepted life as much as they did death. Mm-hmm. And what was also interesting was he had a local craftsman put together a pine box for his casket.
Okay.
The story is that he had a compass, kind of a compass rose put on the top.
Yeah.
And he actually had a keel put on the bottom.
Wow.
Really?
Yep. He said then he would be able to chart a course after death.
Wow.
Oh, so it was kind of this idea that he was already at home, and there's the story goes that he actually slept in it from time to time to make sure it fit okay.
Helmer, get out of your casket. We got work to do here. Come on. Get out there and mow the lawn.
Yeah, wow. I loved hearing Christine in the background and
correcting him.
Yeah, at one point.
No. That was so and so.
Well, at one point, they were talking about Tillamook or something.
Yeah.
And first of all, I think the interviewer was saying Tillamark, that's what he thought Helmer was saying, Tillamark. But in the background, you hear Christine.
Tillamook.
Oh, Tillamook, M-O-O-K. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And I think about that every time I go to the store and see a brand called Tillamook cheese. Every time I see it, I'm thinking of Christine, not Tillamark, Tillamook.
Tillamook, Oregon, the high school team or the cheesemakers. I got to know that through a fellow teacher who grew up in Oregon. It's very close to the Pacific, but they're proud of their cheesemaking. He was out there fishing for halibut, I think, right? Halibut boats and salmon boats, things like that.
On the west coast.
Talked about that one voyage he went out there and they was fishing off the North Pacific and how some of these vintage, you know, well-seasoned Norse fishermen were just getting sick.
Oh, yeah.
Couldn't stand it. And they were, as soon as they got back to land, that was it. They were done. And they were like, wow. Helmer didn't bat an eye, you know?
No.
That was great stuff. So
they turned to farming.
Right. Lubbers at heart, without a doubt, without a doubt. Yeah. So what are you doing right now with the Commercial Fishing Museum, David, and all this hullabaloo. What's the status right now? What's going on with the commercial fishing museum?
Well, what's been exciting about the North Shore Commercial Fishing Museum is the fact that as soon as this came on at the beginning of the summer, we thought for sure that, you know, there would be no tourism whatsoever. People right. were just going to be shut down.
Staying home. Yep.
Yeah, which you both of you probably noticed too, or at least have read that tourism business is booming because everybody's sticking close. So
right.
They had almost 1,000 visitors over the summer. We also put out a letter to some folks that have been longtime members and received some really generous support because of the stories that place can generate and actually kind of preserve, and knowing that a lot of the families up there. So for example, I happened to go up there during a lighting ceremony of the Split Rock Lighthouse.
Okay, yeah.
November 10th each year.
Okay.
For the sinking of the Edmund Fitz.
Right.
And if you haven't ever got a chance, it's certainly worth it. And there's video available this year's, and it's almost it's exactly the same. I mean, they probably read off of laminated sheets, but
sure.
To be honest, it's the hearing the chiming of the bell with each one of the subsequent 29 souls being read.
Wow.
And with the backdrop of the lighthouse as the sun slowly goes down and you can hear the lake in the background. It's not only haunting, but it makes me messed up every time. It's pretty amazing. But what I learned through the North Shore Commercial Fishing Museum was you have to be careful how you talk about that event, meaning the sinking of the Edmund Fitz, because there are families. If you look at where the origin of some of those sailors that went down on the Fitz, a number of those families were from that region. So you'll see Two Harbors, you'll see Schroeder, you'll see Silver Bay, Tofty, so on and so forth. They're still pretty sensitive.
I bet.
Which I didn't know. I thought that would be kind of some folklore, which it is to a certain extent, but it also hits so tremendously close to home. And if you look at some of the folks that were on the Fitz, those were lots of young working men.
Right.
That died in their prime. So right. I guess, you know, it's the kind of perspective that place really brings, but it also brings out folks that really appreciate that old school North Shore feeling. For example, one of the board members is Greg Tofty. He's one of the members of the Tofty family that founded the area. So, and I got to speak with Greg and work with him, and he can spin tales like you wouldn't believe. They're so authentic. It's stuff that you won't see when you go to the typical tourist spots when you're up there. So tales about watching his father and watching relatives and friends going out on the lake, as Helmer would talk about the smoke going 40 feet high.
The lake smokes. Oh, 30, 40 feet high.
And the idea that going out and none of the fishermen back then ever bothered to learn how to swim. They knew that once they were in the lake, they were done for anyway. So what's the point?
Right.
And the treachery of that kind of work, where people would get a foot caught in the net as they threw it, and the other fishermen in the boat would watch them go down, down to the depths. And there are stories where these two fishermen got caught in some wind coming off of the shore, which was pretty typical. As a matter of fact, it's pretty similar to what Helmer got caught in, where it's coming from the northwest as opposed to the northeast, and blowing people out into the shipping channel, for example. And back then, what would typically happen would be those folks that are in those 18-foot skiffs would get blown clear across the lake to the south shore of the Apostle Islands. But in those days, it was fully expected that they would never, ever be seen again. A story was relayed to me where these two fishermen that were relatively young knew that that was probably going to be their fate. However, they wanted their bodies to be found.
Okay.
And they strapped themselves into the boat and then subsequently drifted, were blown clear across the lake. And I think The story goes that they ended up at Devil's Island, which is kind of one of the northernmost ends of the Apostles. And their bodies were actually found. But what makes the story so interesting to think about is, you know, what kind of conversations did those two fishermen have as they commenced strapping themselves down in the boat and going off to their end. But it's not all dark. What's even more beautiful about some of the stories, and I'll kind of start off as we used Helmer as kind of a reference point, but they talked, he was asked about what he thought about it and how he felt about being out on the lake in the middle of those large waves in the middle of the night. And you might recall him saying that,
"There was a nice scenery there at night. The moon was so beautiful."
All the violent nature going on, he really saw through and appreciated his surroundings. And there's stories about children of the fishermen would get in what they called gas boats. Mm-hmm. So as opposed to these sailing boats that they used to have, and this is more of kind of the Isle Royale nature, what happened would they load up. They usually started work pre-dawn, so kind of four-ish in the morning. And the kids would ride on top of this box that was set on top of a motor that essentially was in the middle of an open boat, an open skiff. And the kids kind of wax so lovingly about falling asleep on top of the wooden box while they go across this flat glass Lake Superior that's half orange and half pink on their way to get out of the water. So it really does kind of conjure up, you can almost kind of smell the two-stroke gas exhaust and the smell of the water that I think is unique to that area. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of that beauty, but also the tragedy that's so attractive to it.
Thinking back to what you're talking about with the two gentlemen who got blown across to the Apostles and strapped themselves in, I'm like, you know, I mean, you and I together have been around a lot of those Apostle Islands on sailboats, and I keep thinking, well, there's people everywhere. I mean, how could you not say, well, we're going to get saved here? Back then, probably not. You know, there's nobody out there. And did you get to the bottom of how those two guys met their end, strapped into that boat? I mean, was it just the elements froze them to death, or what happened?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. That's too cold. They were basically washed up on shore. Somebody found them, you know, strapped into their skiff.
Oh, wow. Probably died of hypothermia, I'm guessing.
Right.
Wow. Well, lots of amazing stories coming out of that rather inauspicious little building alongside the highway there. And I think that's on 61. Am I right? I'm not sure.
Is,
yeah.
And going up north, right in downtown.
Downtown. Yeah. Right across from the smoked fish shop and the gas station. So,
right.
Yeah.
Right.
Outstanding. Well, I just remember thinking how cool it was to see all the trappings of those fishermen from the early days, the big, you know, the cotton nets that have been woven and the glass balls that might hold them up at certain times and the weights they would put in, the glass weights as well. And then eventually it was, I think, things like lead. They were weighing down the nets with lead. And the those great old, you know, ripcord kind of Johnson outboards and everything they had, it just really...
Yeah, everything exposed too. Flywheel.
Oh, man, everything. Yeah.
There's certain motors that they actually had to light a modest little fire under in the boat to get running.
To warm things up so they could get the engine running.
That's a great story. In a wooden boat, light the little fire.
Wow.
And hope the boat doesn't go Viking funeral on you, you know?
Yeah.
Well, there they go. She's ablaze.
Wow.
Good knowing them. Yeah. Well, a fun place to be sure. And it's still hale and hearty and running. The museum's up and running. And
it is. I think there's so much heritage up there. It's, you know, what's unique about that place is it's modeled after a fish house.
Right.
So that architecture is designed after a fish house that used to be there not long ago. There, oddly enough, was a gas station there.
Okay.
And once that kind of went belly up, there was enough momentum in that on the North Shore, and particularly that kind of Tofty area, to say we really need, you know, there's so much heritage attached to, you know, Great Lakes commercial fishing and all the way up to Isle Royale. Has a really storied history too, about going back to the heydays of the 1930s, where these kind of boons of lake trout, these huge lake trout, and people spending entire summers, generations of summers on Isle Royale. Silvertson has a gallery up there, and he's actually, when I say up there, I mean Graham Murray, but many of his paintings that he does, and he's a terrific painter that'll paint almost exclusively Isle Royale because that's where his father fished on it, but also down the shore. All of his paintings are actually depictions of scenes out of stories that actually occurred. Those are just great when you... When you see those are beautiful to look at, but that's even a little bit more depth knowing that there's such a great story to each one of those paintings.
Behind every painting, a story, yeah. If you've got the time, he'll maybe sit down and tell you about it.
It's pretty cool. Yeah, I would too.
Well, why don't we take a short break and warm up our coffees while Engineer Don cues up a Cabin Country sponsor or two. But don't go away. We've got more great stories and anecdotes from Cap'n Dave Stricker.
The Cracklin' Jack Pines has always offered you the finest in Northwoods fare. Grilled to your satisfaction, Cracklin' Jack's continues to offer you the opportunity to be the chef, to grill your own choice cuts in our indoor grill room. The best things never change. This weekend, a new offering is on the menu at the Cracklin' Jack Pines. It's turtle chowder time at Cracklin' Jack's. We've been blessed with a king's ransom and choice snapping turtle, and the myriad of meats that a snapper boasts are lovingly crafted into the Mid-South favorite that we're hoping becomes a Cabin Country favorite. Turtle chowder time is here. The best cuts of the turtle are slow cooked with mirepoix and a special seasoning mix until meltingly tender, and then a bevy of vegetables and more spices are added to a reddish gold broth, thickened with roux and just a hint of tomato and Worcestershire sauce. The chowder is allowed to slow simmer until you're ready to order a dinner-sized serving, or perhaps just a tasty cup of chowder that will accompany your elk backstraps hot off our grill room grates. And of course, a shaker of sherry will accompany your chowder to the table, along with plenty of oyster crackers, or if you'd rather, plenty of bread for dipping. Many have thought, turtle chowder? I believe I've missed that train. Well, the time to catch that train is now. Cracklin' Jack Pine's turtle chowder is a short-time offering. Make sure you join us amidst the knotty pine as soon as you can, and enjoy a bowl or a cup of Cracklin' Jack's turtle chowder with your hearty woodlands meal. Whether you're grilling your double-cut North Country Berkshire pork chop, or you're grilling your own whitetail ribeye, you'll be glad you did.
The Cracklin' Jack Pines, Cabin Country's exclusive supper club that offers you a full menu of meaty favorites, hot off the grill or out of the fryer. One of the few Northwoods supper clubs that offers you the opportunity to use our room-sized wood-fired grill so that you can be the chef. And another reminder that Cracklin' Jack's will set you up with salads, sides, and potatoes done to your liking if you choose to grill your own meat. Join us tonight, and don't miss out on this month's special offer. Turtle chowder.
And now, on with the show.
I read in on DNR site, there's now a grand total of 25 licensed commercial fishermen on the lake. Or I should say fisher people. It could be anybody. But that's a very low number, thinking back to the 1930s with people filling boxes full of Ciscos and getting a dollar a box or whatever, sending them off. Or during the war, during World War II, and World War I, both wars, it was a very viable means of income because people were catching fish to send off to the troops. Where are they now? You know, I mean, do any of these folks come in and talk with you all at the museum, or... Is there word out there about, like, oh, this guy or this woman, or they're still fishing this stretch of water?
There's a new generation. As a matter of fact, we have an annual fisherman's dinner every October.
Okay.
And we have one of the fishermen along the shore come and speak, which is interesting, too, because there's always this worry. You know, you have these Norwegian fishermen, and you want them to come and speak in front of a crowd, which seems to be Not really a reasonable expectation.
Right. Rather daunting for these folks.
Right, yeah. Right. It's not really their business. Right. But what the museum's discovered over time is they have such a cache of stories to tell. Once they have maybe a fellow fisherman or somebody they know in the audience that they can kind of go back and forth with.
Right.
Before you know it, the seal's broken and out come the stories. It's just a wonderful event. And like I said, they have more to tell than they give themselves credit for oftentimes. And it has such a local flavor to it where they can speak to certain points or reefs or trends in fishing or talk about the currents in the lake being so powerful where, for example, in the summer, the currents are strong enough where there are times where they can't pull their nets up.
Right.
It's tugging at them hard.
Right.
And there's other stories where, as a matter of fact, I just was turned on to a fisherman named Stephen Dahl. He's a current commercial fisherman out of Knife River. And he supplies a lot of the local fish, particularly herring, almost exclusively herring, to restaurants such as the Scenic Cafe, a lot of the local restaurants. And he talks about is the local food demand is so significant where he'll catch what he can and he doesn't have to worry about selling it. He'll call the local restaurants and say, hey, I've got 20 pounds or I've got 150 pounds. And they'll say, I'll take it.
Right.
I even bought his book. His book is named Knife Island, Circling a Year in a Herring Skiff. And what's kind of fun about this is he actually holds a graduate degree and was in human services for some time. He describes himself as a person that was burnt out as a human services worker.
No. And come on now.
No. Yeah, right. And then now he lives along the old North Shore Road, just north of Duluth, maybe just a touch south of Two Harbors. And he keeps his skiff. It's an 18-foot aluminum skiff at the Knife River Marina. Mm-hmm. And he talks. It's a daily account of what he runs into and how he does his business. And he even says, you know, I'm not going to buy a Mercedes anytime soon. I'm making enough to sustain. Mm-hmm. And he talks about the fact that what's so interesting is the lake is never the same day to day. And he fishes well into December. As a matter of fact, I even called him up. I figured, you know, what's the harm? You can find his number, all fisheries. Mm-hmm. And I called him up to see if I could volunteer to see what a day in the life would be, even if it means going to his fish house and flaying out fish or boxing fish or anything like that. But he's got certain, they call them sets.
Okay.
So certain sets they have. Certain locations that are agreed upon that they fish regularly. They still measure depths and fathoms, so 6 feet. A lot of that maritime language is so in your face, you tend to overthink it. But he said, well, fathoms makes sense because what a fathom is 6 feet is what the average arm span of a fisherman is.
Okay.
He'll talk about some days he'll have 3 herring, other days he'll have 200 pounds of herring. It all depends upon current, and he talks about the fact that commercial fishing is a lot like farming. However, you don't wake up one morning and your corn has somehow moved 5 miles away.
Would certainly make farming more interesting. That's
yeah, right.
Without a doubt. Well, I wonder too if they've got like monikers, you know, names for certain. I'm sure they do. I mean, certain stretches of the water. I was looking through this article from about Mississippi commercial fishing on the Mississippi, and even fewer license types going out to fisher people on the Mississippi. It's an even more rapidly diminishing business. One part in this article, it says, growing up around the old river rats, this guy's name was George Rickman, and he learned the river and its neighborhoods, Blacksmith Slough, the hole, the upper backyard. He's watched islands come and go, you know. I mean, in the river, I suppose they erode away over time and new ones arrive, but I just loved it. And some of the names of some of these people I knew was just right up your alley, you know. Then men made a living on the river. Ted Koba, Brownie Coolis, Ray Martin, Skinner McIlvray. These guys made their living on the Mississippi looking for the rough fish, you know. Yeah. And that's an interesting piece too, Captain. You were talking about this guy, three herring one day, and you know, 300 pounds the next, depending on how the lake behaved. And I found right now that those that are doing commercial fishing on Superior are limited to the following species. There's lake trout, although Helmer made it sound like they kind of came and went, like they're not quite what they used to be.
Some blame it on the smelt.
And then Ciscos, that always struck me as kind of almost more of a Wisconsin term. Maybe it's a North Shore term as well, I'm not sure. Ciscos, I don't know a lot about Ciscos, but chubs, alewives, lake whitefish, round whitefish, pygmy whitefish, rainbow smelt, and rough fish. Oof. And one of these river gents was saying, no, that's where the money is right now, is in rough fish, sheep's head, buffalo head, and carp, because they're all the rage in foreign markets. So digging up the nets out of the muck of the backwaters of the Mississippi and these big slow-moving carp. And it's a story out of Trempolo. It was the La Crosse newspaper. But he says, his fingernails are blackened from years of abuse. He has no feeling in his left middle finger since spearing his hand on a carp's serrated dorsal fin. His 24-foot plate boat was built for a Ferryville angler who later drowned. So he took over this guy's boat and has since, you know, through hard work, he's got black fingernails, no feeling in the middle finger of his left hand.
Taken in a dead man's boat.
Oh, boy, yeah. You know, there's got to be some bad juju there. Where going to sea in a dead man's boat. It sounds like something out of Captain's Courageous or something. It's just crazy. Just crazy. But,
wow.
FUD question? Anything coming to mind at this point? Or I'm kind of running roughshod here. I apologize.
Well, this has been fascinating, but I want to get into Captain Dave's history and becoming a captain.
Yes, yes.
And
a noble seaman.
And of course, you know, we were just thinking commemoratively of the 29 that went down in the Fitz on the 10th, 45th anniversary.
My goodness.
And what came up, of course, as Captain Dave Stricker often does in our shows, is that you had your an adventure going across Superior for what was, you remember the name?
It's like a rough weather test,
yeah,
right, Cap? Where and you got in on some of Helmer's 40-foot smoke.
Oh, 30, 40 feet high.
Said it was a pea super. You were going across in a pea super.
But maybe that's should we start more in the beginning, like the humble beginnings of when you wanted to sail?
Sail Gitche-Gumee. What is it that led you there?
You know, I grew up in Anoka, which is, you know, Anoka is a town that you drive through in order to get to your cabin. So it was a great place to grow up. And at the time, you know, if you were a boy and you liked to fish and you liked to be outdoors, that was a great place to be. And you get a taste for, I remember buying a small fishing boat, you know, with the lawn mowing money, and when you're 13 or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And the transom was gone. You remember the old Alumacrafts where the wooden transom was on there?
Yep.
And you ask somebody where the grass has grown well over the top of this overturned Alumacraft and said, well, how much do you want for it? The guy comes out in his t-shirt with stains on the front, says, well, how much you got, kid? And and I said, you know, how about $100, which is about 75 more than I had. And said that it's yours, but you got to haul it away, of course, which I probably paid too much for. And then I ended up talking my dad into getting that. And then that was kind of the motivation to get out in as much water as I possibly could when I was that age. My parents were game. I'm sure the alternatives were otherwise, but I mean, the kid wants to go fishing, let him go fishing. So
right.
I think what also was attractive, you know, when you're 18, you don't think about college in terms of actually going to school. You think about its sense of place. Mm-hmm. And the Puri was certainly that. And in my time that I'd have, and I think they still do, Wednesday night races. So if you go up there on a Wednesday night, you're going to see 24-foot J boats that come out each night and do races out right underneath the bridge and in the harbor there.
Okay.
I would always like to go down there and, you know, volunteer to, from time to time, they let volunteers on board during those races. And that's kind of where the bug hit. And then before you know it, a real job happens and such. And I stumbled on this opportunity out of Superior Charters in Bayfield, and there was an opportunity before kids. My wife and I ended up taking a three-day course to get charter licensed. And what it was this kind of gruff old Captain Dave was his name. He's still there. I remember this seasoned captain took my wife and I out. We couldn't be any more green and led us through the steps on a 30-foot Sabre, which was a beautiful boat, mid-70s fiberglass sloop rig boat. And he would lead us through about 8-10 hours of instruction every day. And in the evening, he would assign us homework, which was just, if you like charts and you like being on the water and you like boats, being able to sit at the end of the day and just absolutely sun-drenched, wind-blown, and be able to use the spreaders in order to chart a course for the next day as your assignment.
Wow.
There's no better homework.
Right.
So we would get up the next day and do some maneuvering and then docking and different tacking maneuvers and what jibe was and lots of the, you know, that what's so wonderful and romantic about the vocabulary of sailing and maritime, you got to use in real-time terms. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, I remember saying at one point, I haven't been able to find the map. And the captain said, well, I suppose not. There's not a map on the boat.
Get the charts out. I don't know.
You learn the idea that a rope is a rope until it's assigned a duty.
Right.
The idea that it's an anchor rowed once it's attached to the anchor as opposed to a rope, and a painter that attaches to the dinghy and running rigging as opposed to standing rigging and things like that. So. Yeah, if you're in love with the vocabulary, that's the gateway. And we've been doing that consistently for 20 years, as opposed to first time last summer. We did not go sailing last summer, and that was dearly missed by family and not to mention the folks that I get to go with.
Right.
But yeah, going back to the heavy weather course a handful of years ago, about 2 or 3 years. There's an opportunity to take what's called a heavy weather course where initially you start out in Bayfield and you head across the lake. It usually goes between 3 and 4 days. You sail out of Bayfield and then you make your way presumably to Grand Marais.
Okay.
The object is to take it either early in the spring or late in the fall where you actually have to deal with weather.
Right.
And our boat was a 42-footer, a Genoa.
Okay.
It's surprising, you know, those feel so large when you're sitting at the dock. And I know you know what I'm talking about.
Well, even out in the Apostles, you feel like you're on an aircraft carrier.
Yes.
We jokingly refer to it as the RV. It's like, man, we're in this huge, huge boat. This is crazy. But then you get out on Getchigumi, and I'm gathering you probably feel rather small.
Yeah, as soon as you see the islands actually fade behind you, and there's no sense of land.
Oh, boy.
The boat shrinks remarkably.
I'll bet.
Yeah. Yeah, so we were able to move pretty swiftly at about 10 knots, which is just probably in the teens relative to miles per hour, which doesn't seem like a lot, but when you have every stitch of fabric flying and the boat making the sounds that it does, and when it's so, you know, when you have decent wind and everything's really nice and tight,
mm-hmm.
kind of moving along and just enough heel to let you know that the physics are working in your favor.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes.
It's pretty powerful. And the nice thing is you do stay up into twilight and into the evenings, and you do pull watch in the evening, which is interesting. The fact that you're out of sight of land really makes you dial in on the importance of the instruments that are on there, which are even more intriguing once you've lost all bearing.
Yeah.
And learning to trust the, you know, the compass and the chart and then coming upon, you know, an ore boat out of nowhere.
Right.
You know, you think about the Edmund Fitz and you think about the ore boats that are such a part of that area up there, and you actually see one out in the wild, so to speak.
Yeah.
More breathtaking when they're out in the middle of the lake for some reason. I don't know why that is. But Yeah, and the idea that the sailboat has the right of way when your fellow sailor is a motor sailor, that doesn't necessarily work when you're trying, when you're navigating with an oar boat.
It's got to almost feel like when you out nothing but water, and then you see that big oar carrier, and it's almost like spotting Moby Dick or something. It's like, oh my God, look at the size of that thing, you know?
Yeah, yeah, and it's so odd because you see them. You make any kind of trips up to Duluth, you see them so often. They right. almost. Seem to see every day, but when you see them, like you say, out in the big water in their element, there's something awe-inspiring about it.
And probably a little terrifying being in that 42-footer, just thinking, you know, there's nothing but water out here, and there's a lot of distance between us, but it's almost like you're magnetically drawn to this thing. It's like,
yeah.
How do we stay out of its way, you know?
Yeah, and they're not turning anytime soon.
Oh, gosh, no. Yeah, you're not stopping an oar boat. I mean, there's no throwing the props in reverse on an oar boat. You know, it's going to, maybe they can cut speed or something. I'm not sure. But what do you suppose would happen? I mean, did that go through your head out there, Cap, when you were?
I don't know. Yeah, it's hard not to. I mean, you know, when they're so immobile, but the electronics on modern day sailboats are so wonderful.
Yeah.
Where you start to see that off in the distance. And oddly enough, you know, you just want to steer clear of it. But at the same time, you kind of want to get near enough to have a look.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It'd be hard not to. And yeah. I would imagine they're drawing enough of a wake. It could be kind of dangerous having to go behind it.
Right. Right. Yeah. And especially if you hear that kind of, you can hear that cranking, especially as you get astern of those things, you can hear that engine moving.
Right.
Those huge props are really making some power. So
wow.
Not to mention the undertow.
Well, and I would wonder, I mean, a 42-foot sailboat, it was a question I was going to ask, is if you're headed onto the big water. I mean, it's one thing to, and it was always impressive to me, you know, the years that you were kind enough to take me along on those trips out through the Apostles. Yeah, it still felt like pretty big water, and if you went over, it's cold enough that you better get out quickly, you know. But there's land all around you, and there's other sailors, and there's all kinds of this. But all I could think was, like, okay, so we're on a 36-foot. Would you dare take a 36-foot out onto the big lake? You know, and I know it can be done. I mean, Jerry Spies sailed a 10-footer across the Atlantic. You know, he's from my hometown. You know, he was the local hero / psychotic that was like, what's he going to do? You know, and they ran his float through town, you know, after it was all said and done. And there's his little walnut of a sailboat that he went across the Atlantic in, you know, this kind of thing. But I'm thinking, yeah, it can be done, but would you feel safe in anything smaller than, say, a 42-foot? I mean, what is the typical size of a sailboat to be out on?
I think the average minimum is above 30.
Okay.
And then the top ends tends to be kind of the mid-40s, which, as you just described, I mean, that mid-30s is a comfortable, capable, especially in the right hands, terribly capable sailboat that will really go and do anything you would probably want to throw at it. But that said, I think folks that want to make that trip, and there's plenty that have done it, are just really choosy about the times of year that they try to attempt it.
Right, right. Well, now, on your heavy weather trip, you were sent out into a pea super. You were sent out into the lake that smokes. You said 40 feet of fog. And that was kind of socked in the whole way across, right?
It was. We right as we kind of made our way outside of the Apostles, you could start to see the fog start to form. And then, essentially, it wasn't rough enough. It wasn't rough by any stretch. So we were able to keep full sail up, and we even ran the motor from time to time to even make up more time.
Mm-hmm.
And what was fun about it was the fact that you couldn't see anything, but also as you're out on Lake Superior and you're still moving along under sail power, which is actually kind of quiet, the entire boat becomes kind of awash in mist. So it's like everything is wet. So,
okay.
You have your rain gear on, but it's not really raining.
Right.
And you have every stitch of clothing on, but it's still probably in its mid-40s.
Mm-hmm.
But everything is kind of damp because of that mist. You really get a feel for what Lake Superior feels like. And to a certain degree, you know, if you've been up there enough, Lake Superior has a certain smell to it. I don't know if you can identify with it, but I mean, it does have a kind of fresh, clear water sea kind of smell to it.
Right. And inland sea, yeah.
Yes, no kidding. And as we went through there, what was fun was the communication back and forth between boats out there was even more pronounced because, you know, people were trying to maintain contact.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Or making your way across, sure. which is really fun. And also it kind of mitigated that feeling of being alone. There was really no mistaking that you were responsible for your own well-being, mm-hmm. for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is somewhat of the allure to doing that, is the fact that you are taking a certain amount of risk. And it's funny, as I was reading this small book by Stephen Dahl, that Knife Island book, he even makes this connection as he goes out in the boat, in his skiff, when he fishes. And he says that people say, you know, why do you have to pick such a dangerous profession? Mm-hmm. I mean, why do you risk yourself going out onto the water to in such an unforgiving and perhaps unpredictable setting? And he said, why in the world would you drive a 2-ton SUV at 75 mile an hour traffic on a daily basis?
Yeah.
Work every day with kids in it. Why would you take that risk?
Sure.
So his notion of everything is relative kind of captures why I think that's sometimes an allure to folks when you get out on the water. As a matter of fact, Dick Kahlo, one of the owners of Superior Charters, would often talk about the fact that one of the things that people regularly, the sailors that usually come back to sailing on a yearly basis, is the fact that once you're out, you're out. I mean, you're not getting back anytime soon.
Right.
I know you've felt that feeling before.
Oh, yeah.
Where
oh, yeah.
We've spent 8 hours at 5-6 knots.
Yep.
We're not getting back anytime soon.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Where are we dropping anchor tonight? Because we're not getting anywhere else.
Yeah. And even more importantly, have you kept track of where you're at? If you know how to anchor, so you're not going to slip the anchor.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, do you know how the boat swings around in the event, in the likely event, the wind will switch in the middle of the night?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how does the boat swing? And the folks that are attracted to that kind of area and likely to your podcast are the folks that appreciate that sense of self-preservation and the idea that being responsible for yourself is part of the attraction.
Self-reliance. It's all on your shoulders. Right.
Yeah.
That pea super you went through. My question would be, are they following you? I mean, is it a case that, you know, the people know you're out, and if things were to get fairly nasty, they'd dispatch the Coast Guard, or is it sort of a nope?
Nope. Well, within reason. With that particular trip, the charter that this goes out of, they actually have a boat that's owned by the charter company that's got, you know, I think it's got twin 250s on it. It's either a Grady White or a Whaler.
Right.
It's meant to, you know, deal with a little bit of running aground. For example, if somebody sticks the keel in some sand or whatever,
mm-hmm.
or the anchor slips, or somebody's, you know, something's not working on a boat or whatever, they can kind of deal with that. But for example, if you're out in the middle of the larger part of the lake, that's when you start to realize that marine radio channel 16 is a good thing to have, and that's why it's important to keep off that channel 16.
Yeah,
because people are using it in the event that they do run into trouble. So,
okay.
Yeah, and there's a story that I don't know if you remember that story about a kiddo that was on channel 16 for fun. You want me to just tell that story?
Oh, let's hear it.
Yeah,
I feel like that happened to us on an Apostles trip at one point.
Yeah, it was.
Okay.
So there was a kid that was on another boat somewhere, presumably in the Apostles. It was in the Apostles. And it was in the summer. He kept getting on the channel 16, which is a no-no because it's supposed to be kind of an introduction channel where you can either hail another boat and then you switch to another channel,
sure,
another number.
Sure, yep.
And this kid got on the radio, and he probably sounded maybe early teens. And the kid calls out and started talking to somebody else on the radio. And then a reasonable amount of time lapsed, and you hear the Coast Guard break in. Channel 16 is reserved for brief correspondence in emergency situations. Please switch to a different channel. And then that was the end of it. Then probably 2 minutes or later, the same kid jumps back on and does the same routine.
Uh-oh.
And this time the Coast Guard got a little bit more assertive and let less time go by and said, "You're currently on channel 16. Please switch to a different channel." And that was the end of it. And then he got back on again. And less time was allowed to elapse. And the Coast Guard said, "You're currently on channel 16. You need to exit the channel. Please end now."
Right.
And that was the end of it. And then the kid got on again. And the Coast Guard got on and said, "We have a fix of your location. We will be arriving there within minutes."
Uh-oh. So,
wow.
He even gave the kiddo a visit.
Yeah, prepare to be
and
boarded.
I think the parents of the kiddo probably were given a stern lesson on the necessity of Channel 16.
Right.
So,
well, and what was the kid talking about, too? It was like, this other sailing boat went by, you know, there's babes on it, and trying to get a fix on it. You know where they're going? What kind of boat did they have? You know, what was he talking about?
You guys have any beer?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Who knows? Probably talking about snacks or ran out of pop or whatever.
We need more Funyuns over here on the, you know, ocean breeze. Anybody out there?
You're on 16, son.
Yeah, it's crazy how that is, and I would imagine, Captain, if you were in need on your crossing during the fog to talk to, you know, the captain of say an oar boat, you'd hail them on 16 and say, you know, hey, just I'm not sure if you see us, you know, it's 42 footer out of Bayfield, and we're within a quarter mile of you. We're going to try to take evasive action, get out of your way here, but just so you know. Did you get to talk to any of the oar boat captains as you went across? Or
I didn't, but we could hear them on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you could hear them back and forth, kind of announcing where they're at. What's so wonderful about working boats, you know, these kind of working fishing boats, mm-hmm. they have matter-of-fact relationship with nature. You could hear just kind of in the clipped conversation of working mariners, which mm-hmm. It has its own kind of beauty in itself, where right. everything is broken down into what is the essence of what needs to be said.
Right.
Yeah. And not
a paucity of words, yes.
Which I think is an art in and of itself, but it's also, I think it's an art born of years of making sure that you're not only clear, but you're extremely concise.
Right. Right.
Clarity, brevity, and focus. The mariners.
Oh, that's outstanding.
So now on the P Super on your heavy weather ride or sail, excuse me, I'm wondering, well, how many ways can you fail other than, well, he never showed up. It's been 8 days now, so fail. I'm just kind of curious. I was joking last time when we talked about this in the last show. Are there people with clipboards like waiting or in an office?
Yeah. How is that judged? I mean, how would you fail?
How do you get? Earn the merit of, I mean, just making it is one thing, but are there other factors?
Oh, you mean as far as the heavy weather course went?
Right, right.
Yeah, or how do you fail for one thing? And
You didn't do it, of course. Yeah. We're just asking.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Know that there's a Coast Guard captain that's really doing the instruction.
Mm-hmm.
And he's on.
Okay.
Oh.
So that's what you're paying him for, is to kind of lead you through some of those heavy weather maneuvers. And so you only have a certain amount of time that you have to carry out. You have a destination, which, you know, is usually chosen because of what you can do in mm-hmm. that span of that real estate of water.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you have a destination in mind. And kind of it's a great question, because what happened was our whole idea was to make it up to Grand Marais and back in the span of about 3.5 days, which actually is kind of trucking.
Mm-hmm.
And we got out into the lake and reached the Minnesota side almost. And then the wind picked up almost dead out of the northeast. And it was a pretty good clip. I mean, it was well into the 20s as far as knots.
Wow.
But, you know, the shape of the North Shore is basically dead on northeast. Mm-hmm. So we would have had to really beat into, which from a sailing standpoint means you actually basically have to tack into the wind all the way up to Grand Marais, which would take
right
and going in the wrong direction almost 100% of the time. So, which was a great lesson because, again, you're on this 42-foot boat, but before long, you're dealing with, which aren't very sizable waves by Lake Superior terms, but dealing with waves that are 8 or 10 feet high that are breaking over the bow, which is a really, the boat's built to take that and then much more. But
sure,
you definitely feel that the power of looking into those kind of greenish clear waves.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're not stopping.
Right. Yeah.
They're not even breaking yet. Those are just the swells, you know,
right,
and you are humbled so quickly, which again is the fear, but also the kind of thrill of that kind of power of nature. You make the decision of, well, it's fine to say, well, we'll turn around, but actually turning around is a maneuver in itself when you're trying to maneuver that footage of boat around in 8 to 10 foot seas in the middle of nowhere. And knowing that eventually you're going to be in a situation where you're going to be taking, you have to time it in such a way that you want to take a minimum of those waves broadside.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not comfortable or safe. So it's those kind of decisions where you come back around and all of a sudden are really jibing with the wind behind you. And that's a whole other experience where all of a sudden it feels like you have no wind because you really are sailing with the wind. It's actually still where you are now, which is a whole other sense. So, but yeah, I mean, back to your question about, well, how do you fail? I mean, the nice thing, there is a captain there, but the captain is only so good as the crew that he's with. And in this case, it was him. From a female captain standpoint, there's some remarkable ones that charter uses as well. But when you're out there with them, they rely as much on you as they do, as you do on them. So it's definitely an event where you feel part of a team, even though you're out there as part of a course that you're being a part of. So,
right.
Yeah, make it back. And then we ended up essentially blowing into the Silver Bay Marina, if you've ever been up that way. Which is gorgeous in itself and a very much a working marina as far as fishing goes. Mm-hmm. And you get in there and you don't realize how kind of tired and weather beaten you are until you actually put the boat in the slip and you step off. The dock feels pretty good, but everything else is really still bobbing.
So, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh. I remember that well, getting off the boat after 3 days and we weren't in anything to speak of, maybe 4 foot swells at the worst, and still feeling like you're moving from side to side for the next 8 hours, you know, sitting in a car heading back to the Twin Cities, kind of going, why am I still moving? This is nuts. Fudd, did you have some other thoughts you were throwing out? We've kind of taken a fair piece of the captain's time here. I hope you've enjoyed yourself. I mean,
yeah, it's just great. Thanks for, like I say, I appreciate you letting me be part of the fun.
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt. Yeah. I mean, you've got, I think, a storehouse, more stories we may even tap into again in future if you're willing.
Oh yeah,
greatly appreciated, and I am always impressed and slightly awed by your sense of I want to see what it's like to live, get out there and really take this stuff on, where I think a lot of us sort of dare I say sofa sailors kind of sit there and think about it and maybe throw a copy of the DVD Master and Commander in and go, wow, that sounds wonderful, you know, or The Perfect Storm or something, and then go, maybe not.
But two hours fishing on a choppy Lake Osakis was about the extent of my adventure. I remember dreaming of waves that night, but hearing you talk about being on Superior like that and burying rails and lashing yourself and all that kind of stuff.
Suddenly it makes sense, though, when you said, Dave, that you do have a Coast Guard skipper with you as part of the team. That probably made you feel a little more...
Well, that makes sense, because I was thinking like, well, right, Fudd, because you wouldn't send out a student driver getting their license without anybody in it. Well, if you crash, you fail.
Right.
I never even thought that you'd have a...
You're getting your 18-wheel license. Here's the keys. Good luck. Tell give us a call when you get to Anchorage, you know. I doubt that would be the case, but wow. Interesting.
Well, it would give a whole different meaning to cabin country if we actually took cabin country sailing.
Yeah. Oh, that'd be fascinating.
Hey,
that'd be fascinating. As a veteran of a few of those journeys, I will endorse it heartily. And knock on a Formica tabletop here. I've been lucky in my trips that that, you know, 5 to 6 foot swell we sometimes see, that's the, thus far has yet to start putting my innards in a commotion. But I know a lot of our fellows have hove to, dare we say, on the water, and it's changed some thoughts. But it's a great trip. It's a wonderful trip.
Have some fish brats.
Have a fish brat. Yeah. The classic tale. I think we shared that one on the show at one point. How one of
fish
our
brats?
Crew members was allergic to fish, but brought fish bratwurst. And
that doesn't ring a bell.
Oh,
that sounds,
man,
disgusting.
And then the next morning was still feeling seasick because of the motion. And rule one, if you're feeling seasick, get out from under. Get up and see the horizon. Breathe the fresh air. Get on deck. And we could not convince this young lady to get out from under. She was going to stay in that cabin.
Oh, okay. Now it is ringing a bell. Yeah.
She finally did come up, and she had some of these leftover day-old cold fish bratwurst. And there's Captain Dave hanging onto the wheel. I think he had a coffee mug in front of you on the wheel in one hand and this kind of flopping, wobbling fish brat in your hand. Hey, good morning. How about a cold fish brat? Down she went again. We lost her again. And everybody, oh, Captain, come on now. How about an, and then we just shortened it up to F brat. How about an F brat? What do you think? Oh, boy. Yeah.
I don't think we saw her aboard.
That was a one and done. Yeah, she was, that yes. was enough. That wow. Cured her. The F-brats and the motion of the water, that was enough. But all right. Well, thank you much, Captain. And you have a wonderful evening. And thanks for joining us. And we'll be right back after a word from some of our sponsors.
Sounds good.
Gas Station Podcast Network is proud to announce our newest feature, a cooking segment to enjoy while you fill your tank or check the pressure on your ATV's tires, Cabin Cooking with the Parents. This week's Cooking with the Parents recipe, frosted sandwich loaf.
Sometimes there's a big family event happening at the cabin or the lake place, and you need food for a crowd. Try frosted sandwich loaf. Start by pre-ordering several white bread unsliced Pullman loaves from your favorite bakery. Cut several slices lengthwise down the Pullman loaf. Next, mix up a batch of your favorite ham, tuna, or chicken salad. And then spread the layers of bread with roughly a half-inch layer of meat salad. Put a layer of bread on top and repeat the process until you have a layer cake of white bread with alternating layers of ham, tuna, or chicken salad in between each bread layer. Once the loaf is assembled, frost the loaf with a frosting made of equal parts softened cream cheese, mayonnaise, and sour cream. Decorate the loaf with a pattern of Once the loaf is frosted, decorate the loaf with a pattern of thinly sliced rings of green olive stuffed with pimento. Green olive stuffed with pimento. If you're feeling really extravagant, lay out a lattice pattern. Lay out a lattice pattern between the olive slices with anchovy fillets. Man alive, how eyes will pop at the sight of this buffet heavyweight. Cut individual slices of the loaf for your guests. Listen here. Andy, cut individual. Jesus. Sorry, folks. Lloyd's gotten into the laughing gas, and okay, cut.
Well, welcome back. Gosh, it sounds like Lloyd was having a little difficulty there. I hope he doesn't get a call from his agent saying that. GSPN is a little upset with his.
He's appeared to be having some problems tonight, Lloyd.
I guess so. Well, we all get a little tongue-tied, don't we?
I guess so. Don, I was hoping maybe you could help him out there. Good old Lloyd, you know.
Good old Lloyd.
Good old Lloyd.
Yeah, we hope to hear more from good old Lloyd.
Indeed.
Well, another big thanks to Captain Dave Stricker. It was great to hear all those stories.
Captain, good to have him on the show.
So, Kind of hungry for a fish brat. How about you?
Yeah, nice, cold, congealed F-brat. Nothing combats seasickness, FUD, like a...
Wow. That, yeah.
Room temperature, greasy fish brat.
I can't think of anything worse.
Oh, my gosh.
Wow.
Waving it under the face of the victim. This'll help. How about an F-brot?
It's funny because Dave seems like the nicest guy in the world.
Without a doubt.
For him to be teasing with...
He couldn't help himself. I mean, you know, I no slam to the individual, but it was like, you know, we've told you point blank. You come up on deck. You look at the horizon. You breathe fresh air. Oh, no, I can't. I'll stay. Well, how about an F-brot then? How about you wobbling that greasy link? Ugh, crazy.
Wow.
Good to have the captain back on board tonight. And I know he'd been looking forward to it, and we were looking forward to having him. So,
yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Great
I know
tales.
He's a fan of the show.
You
and
bet.
I'm sort of in awe of his adventures
on
the big lake.
No task too great for the captain. He'll take it on.
Excellent.
And all those great kind of insights from the North Country. Help me out here, FUD.
North Shore.
North Shore Commercial Fishing Museum.
That's right.
I said this earlier. I keep getting my merds wixed on this one. I kept referring to it as the Minnesota Commercial Fishing Museum, but it is, in fact, the North Shore Commercial Fishing Museum right up there off Highway 61, Tofty, Minnesota. Right. Well worth the stop. Well worth the stop.
Excellent. Well, I suppose we should... listen for that cabin door shutting and...
Right, enjoy yet another pull off some hot mitts as the fire
right.
rolls and the cabin door slams shut for another evening here on Cabin Country. We hope you'll join us next time for our next episode.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.